great honor and privilege to be here in the opening of the Panhellenic Conference on Informatics. And thank you very much, the organizers, for giving me the opportunity to present my vision and, first of all, the history of virtualization and then my vision on where things go. And to the younger ones in the audience, I would like to say that we have to know very well the past in order to plan for the future. So it's very educating to follow the slides. Although there are many slides, as Mr. Caracola said, but I will try to focus on the most important things. I was impressed, let me say a few words first, I was impressed by the numbers, the people, the organization, and having followed the PCI conference from the very early years. I must say that it is all these little details that sum up and make the conference a successful one. And please allow me to express my gratitude and my congratulations to all the organizers, because it's a lot of work. And from the nitty-gritty details of the map and the places to go around and the schedule and keeping the time, it's all very well organized, and I hope that everything goes well up to the end. Let me try to see if my
the text is
okay. Before starting this long journey to the, not so long, it's 50 years old, but for the young ones it may seem coming from the ancient times, let me say a personal story first. I feel old because 20 years before, in my very early years as a young researcher, okay, I'm still young, I had a publication presentation in a similar event in the fifth Panhellenic Conference on Informatics. This was done in 1995. It was the fifth Panhellenic Conference on Informatics. I think that it was not called such way. It was called the EPI Conference. Jan, correct me if I'm wrong. But okay, it was then matured and became the Panhellenic Conference on Informatics. And I tried to find in my stuff, in my disk, the old presentation, and these were the paper and the slides, which were in transparencies and not with a PowerPoint, not with a computer, but with a headlamp projector. So, if we have to remember two things from my talk, we have to remember two terms. The first one is multiplexing, polyplexia, as we say in Greek. And the second one is abstraction, aphasia. So it's the only two Greek words I have in my slides. So for the non-Greek ones, don't be frightened. The rest of the talk and the rest of the slides are in English. So these two words, multiplexing and abstraction, are very important in all domains of science, and of course in our science. And I will try to persuade you that abstraction and multiplexing led us to virtualization and led us to all this fancy stuff we have with the clouds and the hyperconverges, where I will end my talk. So, let us go a century back. At 1919, where the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T as we know it, was trying to convince the people to use the telephones, and they were bringing a very special technology there, a technology that could allow up to five people to talk together. Wow, amazing. Five people could talk together through the same circuit, through the same coil. And how would AT&T do this? It could do this through the well-known division multiplex. In telecoms, we had this notion of multiplexing for 100 years now. So AT&T was advertising multiplexing in a way to allow many people who currently use the same medium, the same access medium and serve themselves as they were alone. Where else do we have multiplexing apart from our science? We have in the transport area. We know the big highways. We have a lot of lanes, high speed lanes, low speed lanes. We all are multiplexed our cars in the lanes, and we feel that we are alone in the road. Not so alone, because there are the traffic lights, there are the signs, and there are the policemen. But okay, we are all multiplexed on the same street, on the same highway, and we try to be served by the same medium, which is the highway. So in the area of telecoms, the time division multiplexing was the 101 of telecommunications, and the public switch telephone network works this way. We divide the time into slots, and we allocate slots to different users. The second term that I ask you to remember is the term abstraction. The term abstraction is not so clear as the term says. It's abstract. It means that I can leave, omit the details, and take the important stuff and focus on the important stuff. So in our area, if we have an instruction X that wants, if we have instruction X that wants to map to instruction Y, then instead of going with a straight line directly and have direct mapping between X and Y, we have an indirect mapping between translation to X1 and then A, B, C, and then Y1 up to Y. Which means that we can have as many as we like intermediate goals of translating things, but the end goal is reaching the Y for us. Okay, this seems abstract, but we will see how we use it with visualization. Visualization, in fact, is abstraction. It means translating the instruction to something intermediate, to an intermediate format, an intermediate binary format, so we can have a virtual machine instead of a real machine. So, I tried to write the timeline of evolution in visualization, and I would say that we've had a lot of activity in the 60s, whereas we didn't have any activity in the 80s and in the 90s. And I'll try to explain why, from my own eyes, and why we are so hot in the era of 2010 and 2020 as we proceed now. So the first years, the advent of hardware visualization was done practically in 1964. It's a very old machine. I even haven't seen it in front of me, not in a museum, only in Moffett, which is an old airfield in near Silicon Valley, outside San Francisco. There is a very good museum there, a computer history museum, where they have covered on the
we're colleagues, I think.
So in 1964, IBM announced a very big computer, 360, which aimed to address the needs of the scientists and the researchers, which at these times, they were just submitting jobs, their program. There was only one user at the time to this machine. So we were striving to find some hours to use the machine. And the people were striving to, were waiting to get the results because the machine was working in a batch mode. So this means that only one user could use the machine, and he had to wait up to the end so the next user could come. Although it is a very naive way of computing, over 1,000 machines were sold in the first 30 days, which showed how thirsty people were for computing power. So the people at this time, they were very thirsty for computing power, but there were two different approaches. The first approval was by IBM, who was trying to make a unique thing that could serve all the people and have a portable way of moving the programs from one 360 to another 360, even with different architectural characteristics, but with the same batch model, even faster than before. And the same approach came from MIT, from a seminar work by Professor Corbato. I will go to this slide in a while. Many users would concurrently use the same computer and believe that the computer they own the computer. So the first way of doing this was a time sharing system like the one Corbato was. Corbato, as we will see, was working with an IBM machine. But the IBM people had a different perspective on this, and the people from New York and the IBM headquarters addressed the bid of MIT not with a time sharing system as the MIT wanted, but with a different system, which was faster in terms of batch processing. So IBM responded with a bad computer in this bid. They lost the bid. The bid was successful for GE and the labs. And what we know as Unix and his ancestor Multics was the operating system that MIT started, and this was the operating system that succeeded in this bid. So we had a failure for IBM at this particular bid, and as we all know, very good things start with failures. So IBM started losing the bid, and then when Bell Labs did a similar bid for another time-sharing system, then IBM took the work of Professor Corbato and the group that was in Cambridge near MIT, and they addressed, they created the first virtualized machine, which is the CP40. CP40 was not a commercial machine. CP65 was a commercial machine. And why we call it CP? Because it had a control program that controlled the hardware and could expose the hardware to many users, allocating different portions of the machine as different virtual machines. So we have the control program, the ancestor of hypervisor, and we had the operating system, which was a single user operating system, but nevertheless it was an operating system, CMS, so we could have a machine with control program and then CMS. In the slide you can see the original book of the seminal book of Multics. And Multics was this operating system that the project Mark was doing, and it was inspired. This TSS, the time sharing system, was the ancestor of Multics, and then Multics was the ancestor of the Excel we will see in the next slides. So, I just put this slide to show to you that an industrial vendor, IBM, big at this time, they were proposing something different. But MIT University and Bell Labs, another research center, wanted something else. And Bell Labs and MIT were using the technology that was done in-house in MIT from Professor Corbato and his team on an IBM machine. So it's very important, and I take the opportunity to say that it's very important that if there are any guys from the industry, it's very important to have a close collaboration with the industry. And this example here shows us that IBM lost the bit, but could follow the next one and create a virtualized hardware of CPCMS because they had a very good collaboration and a team of people collaborating with MIT inside MIT. So it's very important to have a good collaboration between the industry and academia. And we have numerous examples in our science, and this example is very vivid. It shows what going on. So in the 1960s, in the late 1960s, we had two things to fight each other: batch processing versus time saving. So the people that they were pro operating system, they would say that we would just invent a time sharing system. And the IBMers, the people that come from the big hardware companies, they would say we want batch processing. The people that they were proposing a virtualization, they would propose a virtualization for things like isolation, because if we are many users and we use the same, each one of us has its own VM, we are isolated, so whenever I'm doing something wrong, I don't spoil, I don't block, I don't destroy the VMs of the others, whereas an operating system, I can block, I can break the whole system by doing some malicious code. The people that they were pro virtual machines, they were arguing for ease of system programming, because with a virtual machine to expose the hardware to the program, so the system programming can develop a very good work having the control of the hardware, even if it is virtualized, and the portability of the code, because you can take the VM with the operating system back together and go to a different machine. So, things were maturing, and in 1974, there was a seminal paper by Hockett and Goldberg that were describing the model of hardware, the VMM that we see, the virtual machine monitor, the hypervisor that we know it, which is a piece of software that controls the hardware, and the VMs that interact only with the VMM, interact only with the hypervisor. So we can have plenty of VMs that talk only with the hypervisor, and the hypervisor controls the hardware as the control program that IBM initially originally introduced. And the machine that we all know was the CP67, the IBM CP67 is well known. In Wikipedia, you will see that the first virtualized machine is the CP67, and then the machine 370, which is the next machine. So this seminal paper had two types of hypervisors, as we know them. The type 1 hypervisor, which is the one we say the bare metal hypervisor, means the hypervisor that runs on top of the hardware, controls all the hardware, and exposes the hardware or abstracts the hardware to many virtual machines, to many operating systems on top, to many guest operating systems. And on the other hand, with the type 2 VMM, the type 2 hypervisor, where we have the hardware, we have a tiny operating system that runs together with the hypervisor, which is called the host operating system, and the guest operating system runs on top of the hypervisor. For the younger ones in the audience, you can see that things that they were said in the 1974 are the things that we have now. So we can say that we haven't done so much, because most of the things were said 4 years ago. The modern hypervisor that we have, I'm sure that you all know VMware Work, Oracle X-Sun virtual machines work, Zen Server, are type 1 hypervisors. And type 2 hypervisors were virtual box and the VMware workstation. So the seminal paper of 1974 introduced the two types of hypervisors, bare metal ones or hosted ones. Of course, somebody can ask me, where can we say that KVM belongs? KVM, as we know, is a kernel module, it runs on a host operating system, so it can be considered type 1 hypervisor. So, ending up the IBM story, things matured, and in 1979, this machine was capable of hosting many, many VMs through a hypervisor, which is called control program. The control program controls the hardware. And we have several operating systems here. CMS was an operating system, a single user operating system at this time. We have a DOS, a BATS, VS, another VS1, another operating system. So this machine was a virtualized hardware machine, well sold back in the late 1970s. It would allow concurrent execution of many operating systems. Many users had their own machine, each one of them, and they were tested, developed, etc. So the one thread that was led by IBM, had been influenced by the time sharing systems and what Borbato and MIT was doing, followed the path of hardware virtualization, of splitting the hardware into resources and allocating resources to different virtual machines. The other path that you know mostly is the path of the Unix model, the operating system that was matured in the 1970s, and would time share the hardware, the computer resources to many users. As we know, it's the typical operating system. We have an init process, and we have many users. Each of them can run his own code, but all of us have access to the same kernel, and this may be bad in terms of isolation. But it's very good in terms of exploiting all the capabilities dynamically of the hardware. So the Unix timeline in the 70s was this one. It started with the 1969. We all know the evolution then. It's important to understand that there were two different perspectives. Time sharing the hardware or splitting the hardware and dividing it into virtual machines and sharing. Or coexisting both. And the history showed us that we have to coexist both. So let me proceed with the 1980s. And the advent of the personal computer. We all know that by the end of 1981, opened the architecture, so anybody could make peripherals, cards, etc., that were could interface with the personal computer. This open architecture gave fire to a whole ecosystem of operating systems. And this was very important because 10 years later, we ended up with many, many different operating systems. So, in the 60s, we had a model of a mainframe, which was very expensive. And the problem was how to share it to many users. But in the 80s, there were not so many mainframes, and each one of us had a personal computer. So, initially, the need for virtual machines was not so huge. That's why we couldn't say that the progress in virtual machines was not done in the 80s. Although IBM was selling products that were virtualized in terms of hardware in the 80s, in the 90s, and so forth. But the problem is that the personal computer gave us a lot of computing power that we had in our offices, and the focus was on doing a lot of operating systems. So the VM study became really cold. The operating system were making multitasking, and we had no serious need for VMs. The problem is that things go around. Opening the PC architecture, having a lot of PCs, writing a lot of code brought the need for many from different operating systems. And we had an abundance of operating systems, and we reached at the point that these operating systems should coexist in the same hardware. That's where the need for virtualization came back again. So In the 90s, in the late 90s, we had too many types of operating systems, desktop ones, in the 2000s, even mobile ones, too many flavors, embedded systems one, too many applications, and they're paying the need to host them together into the same hardware. So this is a source, this is a comic, that says that in the 90s we had three operating systems in our house. Now we have four or more, and then the rest is comic. But it shows that we have a lot of operating systems and we have the need to coexist together. At the same time, where we have this boom in operating systems and the need for doing hypervisors for the PC, some people were improving things in the programming language industry. And it's true that the C and C++ were not very easy in terms of porting them to a different machine. So there was a stealth code in some microsystems, which was old folk, and then 1994 Java, which came out of a C++ project they had inside Sun, and they were trying to make things easier for the software engineer to have programs that were portable and could run to different machines. So I'm sure that you all know the Java model, which was pioneering at this time, then many other languages followed. It was the idea of a language virtual machine, which says that we have a source code in Java. We take it out of the Java compiler and we get a bytecode, and then this bytecode runs on any Java virtual machine. So we can have different operating systems as long as they have a JVM, as long as they have a Java virtual machine, they can run our bytecode. And of course, in order to improve things, the JVM we can use a just-in-time compiler to compile dynamically the instructions here and run more efficiently in the hardware platform. So, what the model says, we have an abstraction again, we have a minimum abstraction, that's why we have to remember the word abstraction. We have the source code, which is compiled into an intermediate code named Java bytecode. And then the bytecode can run natively on any hardware as long as we have a virtual machine. But this kind is a language virtual machine, it's not a hardware virtual machine. So virtualization came already to the language domain, also to the application domain. And for the people that they are aware of just-in-time compiler, just a way of not interpreting, but compiling dynamically the bytecode to the target architecture. So, we have virtualization at the hardware level, we had virtualization at the language level. It's true that we were rediscovering virtualization in all areas. And there was a seminar magazine, computer magazine, in 2004, special issue for virtualization technologies. It was explaining why we need virtualization, of course, for isolation, and nothing bad that I do should influence the VM of the others. In terms of reliability, I can take my VM anywhere, I can run it in another hardware, and I can migrate the whole system and all this fancy stuff. So, a modern system looks like this. We have the hardware, we have the hypervisor, and we have many guest operating systems with our application. And we can take this VM and we can put it in another machine. The proliferation of the PC, the opening the architecture of the PC and bringing many operating systems led to the boom in the hypervisor area. So in the 2000, we had 1998 with the VMware. Then KVM, virtual PCs, and virtual box, all of these hypervisors that run natively or host OS on top of an x86 machine. You can see the different characteristics here. Some of them are fully virtualized, some of them are para virtualized. I will explain a little later what them. So there is a whole ecosystem of hypervisors for the common hardware we have, the interfaces. So these are the types of virtualization in terms of hardware virtualization we have today. The machine level, it's the bare metal as we were explaining. We have a lot of operating systems supported all together. The old one, the VM370, was the original machine level hypervisor, and now we have the VMware ESX, Zen, KVM, etc. The operating system level, it's another area that we haven't discussed. It was not so well developed in the 80s, but it came back now. I'm not sure who of you have heard Solaris Zones or FreeBSD or JH. JH were the ancestors of the virtual data phenomenon today. So we have one way of virtualizing the whole hardware and hosting the operating system there and our applications. We have the ability to have on the same operating system different containers that pack only the necessary stuff and our application. So this is the container, the operating system level virtualization we have nowadays, and of course the language level, which is the one of the Java platform and the other platform that we have today. So, to sum up, it depends on the layer of instruction that we want to have. So we have the instruction set architecture abstraction, which is the hardware abstraction. So we have hardware virtualization. If we go to the application binary interface, we have the operating system virtualization, which means different containers. You can see the blue line there. And if we go to the application domain, the language, etc., we go to the application programming, which is the top. So we have three levels, depending on which level is most suitable for our case, or we can have all of them together, and this is the situation today. Some stuff regarding the hardware virtualization, I don't know how much time we have. Types of virtualization, the full, the partial, and parallel virtualization. I'm not going into detail for them. I'm sure that we can have slides and we can find more details elsewhere. The OS level virtualization, which, as I said, is the container stuff we are here today. We are running on top of the same OS. We have multiple isolated but user space. And some people say, is it secure enough? So how much scaling support do I need to run different kinds of containers onto the same operating system? Again, I can have different operating system on the same hardware with hardware virtualization. I can have different applications, different containers, containerized applications with my data on top of the same operating system. This is very, very convenient. How secure is this? And okay, it is secure, but you understand that as long as you go on top of the operating system, things go to the user space, things become a little more tricky, a little more not isolated, a little more insecure, because these containers have access to the same kernel. And the big issue is what about the data containers and how we can have a container moving from one host to another? And of course, at a very high level, at the level of the people in the language are working, we have the language of the machine, we have the abstraction of the machine definition, we have an intermediate code, the bytecode, we translate the source code into a bytecode, and then as long as this bytecode finds a VM to run, it can run in any machine, so we have a portability of the code. And we started with Java, and it's but we have now many scripting languages and with very virtual machines, Ruby, Python, PyPy, and we use their seen for them. So, let me sum up the how we are now. We have a plethora of operating systems, different operating systems for different needs for the same hardware. x86 is a dominant hardware. We have a diversity of workloads. That's that's the situation today. And since we have a diversity of workloads, we have to find a way to deploy them rapidly and to port them from one container to the other. When I say container, I mean from one machine to the other. Now, hypervisors is a mature technology. Hardware hypervisors, like the IBM World, KVM are very mature. And the problem is that with this kind of multiplexing, this kind of exploding the real hardware into many virtual resources. I mean, I have a machine with 6 cores or with 8 cores, and I can virtualize it and I can split it into tens of machines. So we now have tens or thousands of VMs. I mean, I can have a rack of servers, and the rack of servers can contain thousands of VMs. So how can I manage thousands of virtual machines which have their own VMs? So there comes the cloud. So the cloud is a way to orchestrate all these virtual machines that we have in a very convenient way, taking the hassle out of the user and putting it in the data center. So I'm going to speak about the IaaS, the infrastructure as a service clouds. We can call them simply as software stacks to manage our VMs, our hardware VMs. We have the well-known Amazon Cloud, which is based on a closed source solution. And we have open source ones like the OpenStack, the OpenNebula, the CloudStack, and the Cinevo, which was a software stack that we did in Greece while I was with the Greek Research and Education Network. The idea in an IaaS cloud is that the user can spawn a number of VMs out of different flavors, and you will see that the cloud, an IaaS cloud, typically has hundreds of different flavors with different characteristics, different memory size, different number of cores, different number of disks, or size of disk, kind of disk, etc. Okay, so let me say a few words about the original work we have done for the Cinefo software and the Okeanos Cloud, which is one of the largest, or allow me to say that it's still the largest public cloud in Europe. It's a cloud that orchestrates virtual machines of the end users, like you. The design we started was written in the late 2010, 15 code experts. While I was preparing my talk for today, I was revisiting some historical notes from some people in the 60s, and they were saying that any group beyond 12 programmers cannot do substantial work. All the big projects come with less than 12 programmers. One is very few, more than 12 is very big. Take care. Doesn't mean that any group of 12 people can create a software like Unix. So even if Unix was originated by a handful of people, doesn't mean that any handful of people can create the Unix again. So I'm not claiming that the Okeanos is the perfect software, but I'm very proud of the work we did there. And the numbers were really astonishing. You can see thousands of users, thousands of VMs, hundreds of thousands of spawning and respawning and resources, which means that we can build an orchestrator that is really unbreakable and can really support many virtual machines. Why we did the Okeanos? Because at this time there were no big offerings, and the OpenStack, which is well known, didn't work, still doesn't work. But the idea was that we would control our staff. For the last 3 years, up to mid-October 2014, we had a very, very intense
that some very good friends like Panos Lourinas in the infrastructure session will present some details and some applications and services that the GNI is offering on top of the Oceanus Cloud. So Cinefo is the orchestrator that manages all these VMs. And Cinefo is open source, and we had a very good collaboration with Google through their orchestrator Ganeti, and we are contributing still with Ganeti in Google. The idea was that we had virtual machines, any kind of virtual machines, we could scale up to hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands by adding more equipment. And we could start a VM in 3 clicks. Okay, these are some details which show technically why the approach that we follow, the layer, the abstraction approach, was very good and why it leads to the hyperconvergence I'm going to speak in the last 10 minutes. Okay, so the approach we follow was a layer approach. I mean, the resources for the users are these: compute, network, storage, and firewall. And these are for the orchestrator, the virtual machines, the virtual internet, the virtual disk, and the virtual firewalls. So with these Legos, if we put them together in a way that makes sense, we can have this one. So this is the idea, originally the idea of the cloud. We were thinking of very simple bricks that could bring any IT infrastructure, the most complicated one, like this one, I'm shown here, a three-tier architecture made of these virtual bricks, virtual resources coming from the Oceanus cloud. So we have compute VMs, we have network, we have disks, and okay, firewall. So we can build an arbitrary topology of IT based on this Lego stuff. And the idea now, and the difficult part now is if there is a failure in the physical machine that hosts this VM, what will happen to the whole IT infrastructure? So some views, I know that you have seen the UI. So the problem is that from the user perspective, I don't want any failures. I want to scale out, I want to grow. And the problem is that in order to address all these needs from the users, I have a fragmentation of things, fragmentation of infrastructure. Many vendors coming into my data center proposing different solutions, and I have all these different solutions to glue them together. So our data center became a mesh data center. Data center where we had different goods from different vendors. And each vendor was proposing that his management software was doing the right stuff and the others were crap. So the idea is that we had users that they needed available VMs, isolated, with high churn. Things come, I was asking for VMs and I was relinquishing them. From the one hand and from the other hand, I had an HP, an IBM, a Dell server, I had an IMC, NetApp, storage array. So I have two different things to come together. So my server, a fat server with many cores virtualized, is like a big vessel, a big ship with a lot of workload on top. Imagine that you are in the middle of the ocean and that this vessel breaks. What will happen to your container? This is the idea of containers. Okay, another vessel will come, and you have to migrate all your load from this vessel to the new one. Huh? So this happens with one vessel with all these workloads on top of it. And do the analogy: you have a workload in your server, and you have to migrate because a fan broke, a power supply didn't work. So you have to migrate live all your VMs from one machine to. And your data center is like this. Your data center has a lot of workload, different workloads. Each of these containers, I'm sure it's the best. It's the telephone of the user that says, my workload is the best one,
and I want to take care of it. It's the pet of anybody, of everybody. So you have a way to manage all these workloads horizontally and give to any user the ability to use any of these cranes, any of these vessels, because everybody is important. So the problem is much more difficult, much more complicated than in the real world, because in the real world, I'm sure that all these areas are split vertically and statically and shared between different logistic companies. But in our world, any container can use any crane to get its job done, and any vessel to get its to be hosted. Okay, so we have to call somewhere else all this messy stuff and the solution for all this messy stuff. And the solution coming from the vendors' world is called convergence. I mean, for the last 5 years, vendors were coming at GRNet and at other fora in the discussion we had. They were proposing their converged solution, and the word converged is very, very, very nice one. Convergence means that we glue everything together. So I keep saying this stuff, that if you are a blacksmith, you see everything as nails and hammer. So if you are a hardware vendor, you think that the solution would be a big rat like this. So the hardware vendor brought the word converged architecture, which means that we have storage, computing power, cooling, network, and the management software all bundled together in a stuff like this. So Cisco comes, anybody from Cisco here? Cisco comes, IBM comes, and sells you a unified computing infrastructure, converged one, which says that I can host tens of thousands of VMs and hundreds of terabytes and petabytes inside the rack. And this is your cloud. Okay, and I'm asking, if something happens to this rack, if the kind lady that cleans does the hard work and cleans the data center pull out the plug, if the fan breaks, what will happen to all these tens of thousands of VMs inside this cabinet? And the idea is, okay, you can buy a second one, so you can migrate between two of them. And I'm saying, okay, why I have to log into you? Because you have to buy from the same vendor. And they say, don't worry, I'm compatible with the others, but the others have to try more to be compatible with me. So the vendor perspective on how the mesh of data center can be arranged is the converged infrastructure. And the market is really big, so the idea of converging everything to a single chassis, a single cabinet, where you put everything together and you visualize all the layers, is very attractive, but does not work. And does not work because the data center needs to scale out, needs to scale to infinity. All layers should scale to infinity. So the reality in a data center is that we have infrastructure, we have servers, we have storage, we have network, which are independently virtualized, so they are multiplied. So we multiply the resources, we have tens of thousands of network ports, tens of thousands of disks, tens of thousands of VMs, but we have somehow to glue them together, to orchestrate them together. So the idea we follow in our work, the simple software, but this is being followed already by all major data center operators that they are hosting IaaS clouds, is that we try horizontally to glue together vertically partitioned things. I mean, a typical server would have a storage, would have non-virtualized server, would have this kind of stuff, vertically access to storage from each node. When it's virtualized, we have the hypervisor, we have the DSPS, we have the storage here, but we have to make a glue so all the storage is being seen as a unified one. I'm skipping some details to show you what we did. The archipelago approach, the archipelago is the storage that we originally developed inside the Synapo, and this kind of software-defined storage, as we say, decouples the logic of the actual physical storage. So we create a distributed storage system. So this distributed storage system decouples the storage resources from storage packets. So packet means you can buy disks from the Stunara Street. And Stunara Street is the retailers. You can buy any disk you want. You just put a lot of servers with a lot of disks, and you glue them together with the software. And whenever a new VM wants another disk, or when a new VM wants to make a snapshot, it takes blocks, objects, okay, objects out of the disk pool. So the idea is that files, user files, images, I mean templates for creating VMs, volumes, which are the disks that the VMs have, all are considered resources. Snapshots, which are, I press a button and I want to keep a still image of my VM. So this is the architecture of a storage-defined, of a software-defined storage. The architecture says that the backend, okay, cannot be seen very good here, is just a bunch of blocks, a bunch of objects, sorry. And then the user has an image file, it clones it to a disk, and the disk can start a VM, and all these are maps to the same substrate. So the idea with storage-defined, with software-defined storage, is that we have a substrate of objects. In our case, it was the Ceph file system and the Rados object store. And on top of it, we orchestrate differently based on the needs of the users. So the top picture is like this. We have physical hosts with VMs. We have our secret software, and we glue together storage that comes from the retailer. And this can scale out to infinity. The experience we had with this was that we could allow, we could tolerate any kind of upgrades live. So it means that somebody would like to take out the container, the server, and change the file, and the VMs were just migrating to another rack, or they were just migrating to another data center. We could even migrate VMs workloads from one data center to another. And okay, you can ask me what happened with the data, and I'm very happy to answer to you that the data could be also synchronized or moved. Story. So the idea is that the only way you can scale to infinity is to have software-defined data center. It means software controlling all the hardware resources and decoupling the hardware, the virtualized hardware resources from the market. The Synapo software is there. It's being used by several data centers in Europe. Installations in the US, and I'm sure that more details you can find in the infrastructure session. So the challenges we are having, and it's clear how much time I have, I don't have any time. It's the typical answer I get always session chair. What are the challenges we are having? We have diverse workloads, every workload is important. Workloads come and go. We have optimized scheduling. Sure that we know schedulers that come into light now, the Mesos scheduler, Kubernetes, etc., the Omega project from Google. We have to scale anything, cores, number of cores, number of size of memory, disks, etc. I want a user would say, I don't want another disk. I want just my disk to double the number of blocks. And how we control all this stuff, how we control all these resources, the software-defined data set. It means that we control the provisioning of all resources through software, but the resources should be simple, should be naive. We take out all the management software, all the management goodies from the vendors, and we put software. We control with our software the hardware resources, and that's it. So we can do all this kind of stuff, which is very important for a data center, believe me, with applications, snapshots, clones, theme provisioning, replication, synchronization, disaster recovery. You want VM not to be destroyed, but we can take it and go to the other data center, which is 1,000 kilometers away from here. This is what the Google does, and the other Facebook and the other data centers. Out of commodity physical storage. Out of commodity stuff. My kids love the glass story, so I took this comic. It seems that we have to forget the typical disks and we have to focus on the NAND flash. And we all know with the non-volatile memories, the memories will become bigger and the disks will become bigger and will become based on solid state. So we have to forget the typical disks, you know. And you see that the cost, this is the cost per terabyte of the capacity disk and the cost per terabyte of the flash disk. You see the point here, in the next year, and the flash will become cheaper than the magnetic one. So it's really important. So all our storage will be flash. So I'm claiming that, and I'm concluding that the converging, hyper-converging means taking all the resources, gluing them together, controlling them with software, will bring at the storage domain the end of the storage array. There were no cases for storage arrays inside big data centers. Okay, there will be cases for big systems, for big companies like the banks. The banks are still in the area, in the era of COBOL, so it's okay, they can still use the storage array. Magnetic disks. So, to my understanding, the storage arrays are dead. Software-defined storage leads everything in the data center, but which storage hyperconverged one? Chip disks put together, virtualizing the blocks, everything for the VM. This is the ecosystem of big companies that they are dominating the world of software-defined storage, and you can see that all of them are selling software, apart from some of them that are still selling appliances, because it's a psychological way. I'm purchasing new equipment, I have to see it, whereas when I'm buying software, I don't see it, so I cannot claim the money that I have used. By this, I'm finishing. It's really important to understand that we are living in an era of changing of paradigm. We have virtualized everything, from machines to networks to disks. So all the resources in the data center are being virtualized. We have control. How we control them in a unified way with the software. The problem is that when we ask a typical user, he says, buy another cabinet of disks, buy another array of disks. So this quote by Henry Ford reminds me what we are living nowadays. People are selling to us arrays, vertically converged, as they say, equipment, but we need horizontal unification, we need something else. We need a machine, we don't need more horses. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this insightful and fascinating presentation. We could take one or two questions if you... Yes, Mr. Vasilianis.
Thank you for your talk, and I would like to congratulate you for the Okeanos project, which I'm one of the first adopters of this technology. And in fact, I was using, I was with my students, I'm teaching distributed systems, OpenMPI, and we were constructing big clusters of it, and we were using it in teaching parallelization techniques. And I would like to comment on a phrase that you said a couple of times, the scale to infinity. It seems that even though software can support scaling, economics does not support scaling. And for this reason, the Okeanos project has been paused for new users, and only the old users, like me and my previous students, can use it. So one of the questions is about Okeanos, and do you think that, first of all, it will expand, or due to stringent economics in Greece, it will shut down as some things tend to close down? Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm really delighted that you were one of the first adopters of the Okeanos service, and that you enjoy the service. I'm also using it for my courses, and it's a perfect way of organizing a course with hundreds of VAs for hundreds of students in at one time. What the academics will say is that we design things. We have the ambition to scale to infinity, as I said. But the problem is that the fact that Okeanos does not scale now is not due to the software, or not due to our design. It's due to the beats, to the bureaucracy, and to the way things work when you are leading a big beat in Greece. And I would like to separate these two things. The software is very good. It needed insight and a lot of design in the previous years. But now it's very mature. And the fact that the users do not enjoy this kind of stuff is that people at GRNet, and because I'm not a member of the GRNet from last December, people at GRNet have their hands tied, they cannot buy more equipment. So at the end of the day, you need more servers, you need more storage, you need more pieces. So I'm sure that they are planning, they are at the moment they have open bits, and they will soon increase the physical resources, because in order to virtualize the resources, you need to have the physical ones first. As far as I know, they will put more iron to the data center, and they're increasing the number of data centers. So you will have soon better news than the one you had in the last year. But the software was a very good example of how with the software you can control the hardware resources.
Thank you very much. And I think this concludes our keynote. I'm sorry to have to end this. We need to start our parallel sessions in 3:30, so you have some short time for a coffee break.